Postmodernism, What Does It Have Right? Was presented by Jack Crabtree on August 13, 2003 at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Postmodernism, Reason, and the Church. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Why are we giving any merit or any credit to postmodernism for something as ancient, as old, and as traditional as we need to love one another? As I'm looking at postmodernism, I'm not looking at it the way the evangelical postmodernists of today are looking at it, where they're looking at relationship and community and all that kind of stuff, because obviously there's some merit to that. That's valuable. But what makes postmodernism distinctively postmodernism in the way that I'm looking at it has to do with their view of knowledge and reason. And that's at the heart of the problem that I want to look at. At the heart of postmodernism is the insight that rationality is the product of human culture and is not a universal and fixed and natural attribute. And so what I want to argue in this lecture, in this session, is that there's something fundamentally right about that. That's true. We need to be clear about exactly in what sense that's right, but the fact that there's something fundamentally right about that is important to grasp. So let's look at the relationship between culture and reason, but to do that I need to go and revisit the distinction I made yesterday between within reason, within what we might call rationality. We can really be talking about two entirely different things. One is what I have labeled the ROM by a computer model, and the other the RAM. And let me be a little bit more specific about what I mean by those. In the ROM of human rationality are logical functions, so the law of non-contradiction, the law of the excluded middle, all those basic fundamental logical principles and logical laws that a logician formulates in formal logic and that every human being operates according to, whether they know that's what they're doing or not. Those logical functions that we use to deduce, to infer, to induce, inductive logic, I think, is up here as well. Those functions of the human mind are built in, hardwired in. Also, however, that wouldn't be enough, as any logician knows. If all you had were logical functions, that gets you absolutely nowhere. You don't come to knowledge that way. This is simply a standard for judging the inferences that we make. But you have to infer from other ideas, beliefs, or propositions. Whatever you infer has to start with certain beliefs that you're drawing inferences from. Well, the problem is, if you start with a blank slate, with no beliefs, nothing to infer from, how do you get anywhere? And a traditional theory of knowledge is what's called foundationalism. Foundationalism is the view that there are some basic beliefs, basic ideas that lie at the foundation of our knowledge, from which everything else that we know and believe has been derived, or in a kind of inferential relationship. We started with certain knowledge and we inferred the rest of it. Now, foundationalism is being challenged by Nietzsche, ever so subtly, but I think he's challenging that. Postmodernism has abandoned foundationalism completely. They don't believe that there are these certain basic beliefs that are universally held and form the foundation of all knowledge from which all other knowledge is built up. All knowledge, every shred of knowledge, is constructed by the individual. And so the whole range of all of my knowledge, none of it is grounded in anything foundational. It's all sort of floating in midair. ungrounded, unconnected. It's not connected to the world, and it's not connected to prior beliefs. It's just there. It's just a game that we play according to certain rules that we accept. And beyond that, there's no other significance to it. Now, they may not emphasize that, and they may not land on that. That's not so much what they are promoting as what they are presupposing. They've accepted that people like Nietzsche have shown us once and for all that there's no sense in thinking of our knowledge as it all relating to reality, as telling us anything about reality. So I think they're presupposing that. They're rejecting foundationalism. One of the Thomas Reed is clearly a foundationalist. I mean, he's a stereotypical foundationalist. One way he gets misunderstood and criticized is he talks about these principles. You didn't read all of his principles, his whole list of principles. Some of them are pretty sophisticated. I think I mentioned yesterday the principle of credulity. That he talks about the principle of credulity, which I think is a very profound insight into the way human knowledge works. But that's a pretty sophisticated, that's a pretty incredible thing to believe, to come already hardwired to believe, that when people tell me something, I'll believe it unless I have a good reason not to. Another one of his foundational beliefs is there is an external world that I know. I don't remember how he puts it, but basically what I am learning through my sense experience is something about an enduring, existing external world out there. He says we're hardwired. We come hardwired to believe that. Now, one of the obvious objections that could be raised to that is, if you go interview your three-month-old and say, do you believe in an external world? You're not going to get a yes answer. And so a kind of a cheap criticism of Reed is, I know my kids didn't already believe this stuff. Well, when Thomas Reed lays out these principles, he's not doing so. This principle, this belief, this proposition that we all hold, he doesn't mean to say we hold it in the form of a propositional belief. He, as a philosopher, is reflecting on the structures of human rationality, the structure of the human mind, and he's saying the operations and the assumptions that we need in order to learn are already hardwired in. We are not conscious of believing the foundational beliefs that we believe, but we don't need to be conscious of believing them in order to operate according to them. And so I think I mentioned yesterday, the infant in the crib is operating on the assumption that there really is some kind of coherence to the world outside of him. Otherwise, every experience an infant would have would be, whoa, far out, look at that color patch. And it would go no further, because it would just be a forceful and vivacious experience, you know. But there would be no attempt. It wouldn't be logical to try to make sense out of your world if you didn't believe there was sense to be made out of your world. So the human mind, as it develops, it operates on the assumption that there is sense to be made out of the world, and then operates accordingly. And that's built in, Thomas Reed is saying. I think that's right. Okay, so we're not dealing with any actual beliefs up here in the foundations. It's simply built-in, hardwired assumptions that define our procedures, not our propositions and our language and the way we articulate. All that we have to learn, and part of that is through self-reflection on watching what we already have done in the past. It's in the RAM, what I'm calling the RAM, that knowledge is inferred on the basis, on the foundation of what has been hardwired in. And it's based on the beliefs that are hardwired in, the functions that are hardwired in, and the data that we gain from my experience. If I have limited experience, that's going to limit my knowledge, because I can only learn based on the data. I can only build my knowledge based on the data of the experience I have. And this is one of the reasons why, of course, infallible knowledge is not possible, because we always have limited data that we're working with. There's always the possibility that there's other examples, other instances, other particulars that are going to blow my knowledge apart. And that's why we always have to have the humility that these guys are talking about, because we don't know it all. So another way of looking at it is the RAM is constituted by this worldview that I hold, that I have constructed, and that I am continuing to construct throughout the rest of my life. That's what I'm calling the RAM. Well, can we call that rationality? Yes, it makes sense to call that rationality, because it's out of this worldview that everything else that I perceive, encounter, experience, and believe gets interpreted. I interpret things in the light of what I already know to be true. Whether what I already know to be true is accurate or not doesn't really make any difference. It only makes sense, it's only efficient and economical, that I would always assume that the truth that I have come to believe is true is true, and try to advance my knowledge from there, rather than always second-guess myself and always go back to the drawing board and always try to begin building from the foundation up every time I have a new experience. That just doesn't even make any sense. And so I think what Thomas Reed would say is built into the very foundations is this kind of conservatism where we assume that the knowledge I already have is valid and try to interpret all of life in the light of the worldview that I already have. That's a rational thing to do. It's not an infallible thing to do. It doesn't always lead me to truth, but it's a rational thing to do. Okay, so what forces affect this worldview that gets constructed? All kinds of stuff, in addition to the data from experience. My culture hands me concepts. It hands me the language to use. It hands me values. I just absorb them with the air I breathe. I just take in all kinds of stuff that makes up the worldview that is my rationality through which I'm encountering reality. The particular social network that I hang with. My parents are a big influence. The various institutions, the church, the government, the academy, the college, the university, all those things, I spelled it wrong, didn't I? No, I didn't. All these things are having a huge impact in shaping my RAM. The physical culture, we often neglect that. I think it's Gergen brings up Peter Berger. Wes introduced me to Peter Berger years ago, what's called the sociology of knowledge, how much the literal physical culture, TVs, CD players, garage door openers, can openers, the automobiles we drive, the physical objects of our universe transform the nature of our lives, and by transforming the nature of our lives and our experience gives us a new and different kind of data. And that new and different kind of data plays back on the worldview that I construct. So there's just all kinds of ways that all those things are shaping how we look at the world, how we perceive reality. Our very rationality, our very minds are being created by all these influences. Okay, so I think the most charitable way to understand what the postmodernists are saying when they say things like reason is a social construct, a cultural construct, that's what they're saying. They're just simply noticing and observing the fact that so much of what makes me believe what I believe and know what I know is not a personal thing. You know, it's not that I chose it, that I invented it. It wasn't original to me. It was all these forces impinged upon me and molded and shaped and created my way of looking at the world, my mind, and made it what it is. And I don't think they're wrong about that. They're right about that. Now, one of the things that's very distinctive about postmodernism in the sense that I'm using it is one of the things that a culture will give you and make up your worldview and your RAM is what some have called a meta-narrative. And what they mean by meta-narrative, I don't know if this is worth it, but let me give you the story. Where does this meta come from? In the Middle Ages, Aristotle wrote two works. One was on nature, which in Greek is physis, from which we get physics, and so we translate it physics. So there's this work of Aristotle called Physics. There's this other work that he wrote where it's a more abstract work. You're no longer talking about animals and objects and things moving in the world, but being itself. Things that a toad and a star have in common is that they both have being or existence. Well, if you're not studying toadness and you're not studying starness, but you're studying beingness, which is a more general abstract category, you're studying something else. And he had a whole work devoted to that. Whoever compiled his works in the Middle Ages didn't know what to title it. So he used the Greek word meta, which means after, metaphysics, which means after physics. Here's physics, and the next in the volume is going to be after physics, metaphysics. Well, it stuck. The word, it makes no sense, but the word is what stuck to describe the discipline where you're studying the most abstract things about existence and reality. Well, because of that device, going from physics to metaphysics, some clever 20th century philosopher decided we can do that too. And so there came this tool that they used. Whenever you want to talk about a more abstract version of something, you just put the prefix meta in front of it. So a meta-narrative is that what they're getting at there is we have all these stories that are playing out in the drama of human existence, all these narratives that are being played out that are individual narratives that have local explanations. I mean, you could explain the causes and effects of World War II, for example. There's a local story to be told about what happened there in history, or the story to be told about God's dealing with the Jews, or the story to be told about this, or the story to be told about that. But is there any story underneath all the other stories that gives coherence and meaning to the whole lot of them? And postmodernism is taking a little bit further. Not only do you have local stories, but you have different stories that people tell themselves. I may tell myself a different story about the same event than you will. So we don't even always necessarily tell the same story as an explanation for the same event that we've experienced. But when all is said and done, is there some story underlying all the stories that human beings tell themselves to understand their reality that actually judges them as accurate or inaccurate, as wrong or right, as significant or insignificant? Is there any one final story that is really ultimately true, the true story? And postmodernism is categorically, as I'm understanding it, is categorically rejecting that. No, there's no such thing. All we have are our own individual stories that we tell in order to make sense out of history, our life, our experience, whatever. That's all there is. And there's nothing that can judge one of them valid and the next one invalid, one of them true and the next one false, one of them significant and the other one insignificant. There's no basis that we have, no underlying story that provides a ground for making that kind of assessment, not judgment. What was I talking about? Yeah, but why?
Cultural
rush.
You're supposed to get to why
it's good. Oh, yeah. Okay. Actually, I think there was a more particular... look at my notes. Let's do that. Okay. So I want to talk more about that tomorrow because that's the part of postmodernism that I would say is wrong. The rejection of the meta-narrative, I think, is wrong. But the part of it here where the way I get at my, I mean, I may tell myself a meta-narrative, that's part of my worldview. Is that a construct? Yes, it is. And I'm shaped and influenced by my culture, by my church, by my parents, and all that kind of stuff. Now, that's true, but is that a new discovery? Is that original? Is that... It may seem to us that it is, because, as we're learning, postmodernism is a reaction to modernism, and modernism, in a way... Modernism so downplayed the personal construction dimension to reason that it tried to pretend, it tried to live with the illusion that rationality is just this thing, it just is what it is, and it takes in the data of experience like a machine, and it just cranks away, and it comes up with the product of truth. Just this mechanical process that's going to kind of crank out truth. And the only thing that could possibly get in the way is religion, metaphysics, superstition, stuff that kind of gums up the works of the machine. But if we just get the stuff out of the way that gums up the works of the machine, reason is just going to crank away and crank out the truth. Well, postmodernism recognizes that it doesn't work that way. Rationality is not machine-like in the way it works. We, in our freedom, are making choices. We are building our worldview block by block, making free choices as we do so, and our choices are influenced by all kinds of values, desires, passions, personal stuff that makes my construction of the world my construction of the world, my own personal construction of the world. Again, I go back to Michael Polanyi's personal knowledge that Charlie mentioned. That's part of what he was saying, is that this is not a machine in here, this is a mind in here. And this mind is doing what minds do, what reason does, what people do. It's seeking deliberately, purposely, to seek out an understanding of the world that makes sense. And ultimately, that gets at the way the world actually is. It's this mind doing this, not this machine. So in reaction to that, postmodernism sounds new, fresh, original, liberating in a certain way, much more realistic, much more like the way the world actually works. But the fact of the matter is, Christians have been saying that forever. It goes all the way back to the New Testament. In the New Testament, for example, the Apostle John, his whole concept of the world in 1 John presupposes the constructed nature of my worldview, I would argue. Let me explain. John says, "Do not love the world or the things in the world, for if you love the world, the things of the Father, the love of the Father is not in you." And then he talks about the world passing away and so on. Well, what does he mean by the world? I used to think, until I studied 1 John most recently, I used to think that the world was just literally the physical material reality that we live in, and that what he's saying is don't be attached to stuff. Don't be attached to the experiences, the delights, the joys, the rewards of physical material existence. He would say that, but I don't think that's what he's saying there. Because I think what he means by the world is the world is a concept, is a word he uses to describe universal culture. And I think that's the way Paul uses it as well. What they both recognize is there's a culture that humanity has constructed, has created. It is a... It's built on lies. It's a fabric of lies. And what is this world culture founded on? Hatred of God, rejection of God and all that he stands for, rebellion against truth, rebellion against goodness, rebellion against justice, compassion, love, and all the things that are the attributes of God, a disregard for the purposes of God and a desire to replace the purposes of God with purposes of my own choosing. And all of mankind is united in a culture that accepts all those propositions, all those values, all those perceptions and beliefs that go contrary to what is actually true. So the world is a transcultural culture. I mean, that's not just America, that's not just Germany, it's not just Japan and China. The whole cotton-picking world, from the Aboriginal to the highly sophisticated empires, they all share in common a tendency, a proclivity to coalesce around a rejection of God and all that that entails. Well, that's what John calls the world. And he's talking about a culture that has imbibed a certain class of worldviews. Well, none of that makes any sense if you have a modernist view of rationality. The only way that makes any sense is if we are constructing our worldviews out of our freedom, out of our free moral agency, which gives us some latitude to decide what we will and what we won't believe. So that's assumed again then in Romans when Paul says, do not be conformed to this world, but be renewed by the transformation of your mind. Is that right? Did I get that right? Do not be conformed to this world, but be renewed be transformed in the renewal of your mind. Yeah. Well, in the renewal of your mind, that's talking about, he could have said, in the deconstruction of your old rationality and the reconstruction of a new rationality, is what he's saying there. So don't be conformed to the world. Don't accept their assumptions, their worldview, their proclivities. Don't accept those. Be transformed. And you'll see a renewal of your mind. So that's presupposing this postmodern conception of rationality. That's in the New Testament, and we could probably look at, I mean, every place where the word world is used, I think that's being presupposed. I think in Romans 12, that's being presupposed very clearly and explicitly, and it sort of underlies everything that the apostles are teaching. Beyond that, in the Reformed tradition in particular, they have been very sensitive to this reality for a long time. Van Til is probably the most recent and the most famous. Van Til's hard to understand. It's hard to know exactly what he's saying, but I think the most charitable reading of Van Til is that he's recognizing the fact that you choose your worldview. And the theist has chosen to construct a worldview that makes room for God. The non-believer has chosen to reject that worldview and embrace another one. And Van Til's point is, by virtue of the fact that they have chosen such radically different worldviews, they are in two different minds such that they can't possibly communicate with each other. What's evidence for this person is not evidence for this person. What's compelling to this person will not be at all compelling to this person. And he's right about that so far as talking out of our worldviews to one another is concerned. Now, I think the mistake that Van Til makes is he says we have no common ground whatsoever. The believer and the non-believer have no common ground whatsoever. And I think that's wrong, and I don't even think that's the perspective the New Testament takes, because we can go back to this. This, actually, and this, the data from experience. We do have common ground from the same, we're starting from the same ROM, and we can have overlapping data from experience. It's just, what I should have put it here is the ROM plus the data from experience plus my free choice in constructing the worldview that I choose to construct. And this is where we part company. It's in our freedom that we decide to do something different with the data from experience. So my problem with Van Til and the people that are in the Van Til camp, and I find the same problem in the postmodernist thinkers, is that they don't make this distinction. And since they don't make this distinction, at least they don't make it explicit. It might be implicit in some of them, but they don't make it explicit. And so it sounds like what they're saying is that reason and rationality across the board, in its entirety, in toto, all of rationality and everything about it is a social construct. And so you'll have people at least intimate that even the law of contradiction, law of non-contradiction, and the basic fundamental logical functions, when all is said and done, are nothing but logical constructs. It's just part of the story that we've told ourselves, and we can tell ourselves that story if we want to, but we don't have to. Any story that we would construct is equally valid, and if we wanted to tell a story and build a story that is not based on traditional logic, we could do that. Well, I look at that and I say, that's crazy. I mean, that doesn't make any sense at all. But once we have distinguished that and limit ourselves to talking about the impact of culture and all that stuff on the world we build on those foundations, then I think they are profoundly right, but not particularly original. That the Bible and Christianity has, for long ages, been saying the same thing. Okay. I then want to go on to talk about what's wrong with it, but I'll save that for tomorrow, so I'm quitting early. Let's just spend more time in responding to your questions and comments. And there's a lot that can be said about this, but let me talk about what you're interested in.
Van Tillen, he said he's talking out of the worldview with someone else is, in a sense, it's kind of futile. Is that what he's saying? But you're saying that there's some overlapping in the RAM part, in the RAM, because doesn't the memory of our worldview that we held before, does that doesn't speak? You know what I'm saying? That because we've deconstructed an old worldview, and we still have the memory of that, and we've constructed a new worldview. Doesn't that still kind of overlap? Doesn't that still have some sort of weight in talking to someone?
Right. We could certainly relate to their worldview. Yeah, and I probably he wouldn't deny that. But what he's arguing is that we build our worldview from certain underlying assumptions that we make, and once you start with their assumptions, you're not going to be able to grant them their assumptions and get to God, get to belief in God, because they've already precluded the existence of God in the very assumptions that they have. Embraced. So he's probably right about that. But what he seems to be arguing is that there's really no point in trying to make an argument or trying to make a case for Christianity if God doesn't open up their eyes and their hearts to the initial assumptions that they need to buy into, and just bring them in a kind of moment of conversion to embrace those assumptions rather than the old ones, until and unless that happens, yeah, you're just wasting your breath and you're not going to get anywhere with them. That's what I disagree with. I mean, I don't agree with that, because I can go back, I can count on them operating according to the law of non-contradiction, the laws of cause and effect, all the logical functions, and we can go and re-examine the way that they have interpreted the data from their experience. And I would argue what we will find in the end is they haven't given the most reasonable interpretation to some of that data. They haven't. They may not admit that, but that's a point where we can argue with one another. And ultimately, what I'm going to be doing in apologetics is basically calling them to re-examine, have you really dealt with your experience with intellectual integrity or not? If I'm right, they haven't. They haven't dealt with their experience with intellectual integrity. I can't make them start doing that. I mean, Van Til's right about that. I can't make them start doing that, but I at least can make clear what the issue is and confront them with the question. Now, I'll give you an example. When I was in college, we were on an evangelistic mission to Willamette University up the valley.
Stanford, what?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, the Christians on the stand. Yeah, that's funny, isn't it? And so I was in a dorm, and I was arguing with this guy about the resurrection, whether or not there was a resurrection. And I didn't know this until afterwards, but this guy was a debater, and he prided himself in his debating skills or something. And, I mean, he probably could have run circles around me, but he made a fatal flaw, and I exploited it. And so I got to a point where I said something. I don't remember the details of the argument, but I said something, and he said, and he stopped, and he paused, and he said, "Well, yeah, you're right. I guess it makes sense that Jesus did raise from the dead." And then I was trying to be cute rather than, I wasn't really serious, but my next question was, "So how come you're not a Christian?" And before I could even get the question out of my mouth, I mean, the debater in him, "Aha, that's a different question." And, you know, touche, yep, that's an entirely different question. But he had the freedom to look at, I mean, what he's conceding, I mean, whether he's really conceding or not, at least he's explicitly stating that he's conceding that reason is on the side of accepting the objective reality that Jesus raised from the dead. But is that going to lead to belief and to embracing the biblical worldview? No, that's a different question. But I think what I did succeed in doing in that event was letting him, making clear to him personally that that was a different question. Don't give me this BS about you don't have reasons to believe then, because the real motive for your unbelief is not lack of evidence, lack of reasons. The real reason for your unbelief is, frankly, you don't want to. And when a person comes to that realization, that may not lead them to repentance. But as I mentioned in Ron's experience, that was key to his repentance, when he realized that what stands between me and belief is not rationality, but my own willfulness. It's not quite as noble to say, "I don't believe in Christianity because I don't want to." That's not nearly as noble as, I don't believe in Christianity because, frankly, I'm a person of impeccable intellectual integrity and I just don't have enough evidence to compel me. It's much more noble.
And so when dealing with someone who's thinking on a more postmodern bent, and they're not distinguishing between the ROM and the RAM, what's the point? You know, like, how do you... Is it like Van Til says, is it just like, is it futile? Because if they don't believe in the reason to begin with, or the rationality to begin with, then you talking to them and stepping them back and saying, "Look, it's at this point where you're not dealing with where you've gone wrong, or it's at this point in your experience where you're not completely filled in." Is it at this point where you just kind of step back and you go, "Yeah, I'm going to have to leave you your own device"?
Well, the only thing I know to do, and like I've been successful, but the only thing I know to do, the only thing that makes sense for me to do, when someone starts rejecting the law of non-contradiction and the law of excluded middle and logic and all the stuff that is just commonsensical, when in order to block the arguments for Christianity, they're willing to even abandon and reject common sense, the only thing I can know to do is to say, "I don't believe you. I don't think you're being sincere. You say you don't believe in the law of non-contradiction. Let me videotape a day of your life and see if you believe in the law of non-contradiction or not. Because I just can't take you seriously. I just think this is a bluff. I don't believe that for a second." And probably what they're going to respond is, "No, I'm dead serious. I really don't believe in the law of non-contradiction." And then I don't know what else you can do but throw up your hands. But at least I've planted the seed. Are you really serious? Are you really sincere? Is this a serious-minded search for truth here that you're engaged in, or are you just playing a game?
Yeah.
And beyond that, I don't know where you can go.
It seems to me, Jack, that it's never quite this simple. And what I mean is that it's not that clear to us, to most people, I don't think it's that clear why we don't believe or what we're really identifying as. I don't think that this is a normal process, if you will. Does that make sense? To kind of go through and articulate. I think it's a really helpful process. But when I think about the conversation that Adam is envisioning, I guess my response is, I think we can listen to one another. And I think that's a really good thing to do, because in listening to someone, it gives them the opportunity to hear what they believe and to wrestle with it. And I think that is far more, I'm struggling with the word, loving? I don't know. It gives credence to the reality of what you're talking about, that that it isn't being able to logically defend our faith that's going to convince anyone, but our own experience, our own bumping into ourselves, our own experience of relationships and the world that we live in that confronts us with things we have to interpret, I guess. And so I guess I just wanted to say, I think listening is a really good thing to do, because in our saturated selves in this culture, in Gergen's words, it's like we don't do that very often. We don't really know what we think very often,
mm-hmm.
and even listen to ourselves. And so I think giving that opportunity to other people is a really good thing to do.
Yeah, but I would add to that. I think what you're saying is really true, very very true. But I do think we need to react, because that stuff that Gergen was talking about how did he put it? But truth is majority vote, or I can't remember how he put it. But it's we believe things to be true because there's this social support, there's this plausibility structure that's propping it up. It seems to me a loving thing to do is to call in, is to not be a part of that plausibility structure when it's a lie that people are believing. Now, we don't have to be rude about it and kind about it, but to simply register the vote, that doesn't make sense to me.
Sure, and I guess my definition of listening is a very active thing. It's not.
Okay.
I'm not just letting them go on and on. I'm engaging in it, but I'm curious, and I'm taking the position of being curious about how they're putting that together, rather than running over them with what I think and what I see first and foremost.
Yeah, yeah.
So I do absolutely agree that wrestling with it is a part of that listening process.
Okay.
Nancy, what you're saying kind of leads me also to what I think is a presupposition behind wanting to have these conversations with other people, other than the obvious, that they seem to be about the most important questions. That leads me to the idea of the motivation behind evangelism. Again, I'm most interested in these inroads into how postmodernism reveals itself in the church, and was certainly struck by the articles as our examples today and how poorly they demonstrated that. And in fact, in the sense that the authors themselves were trying to assert those. Instead, I believe the authors themselves are the best examples of postmodernism in the way they communicate and why they're communicating. Basically, in terms of evangelism, the focus seems to mirror postmodernism, in as much as it seems to be about imparting the information of Christianity, imparting some image of Christianity into another human being and being convinced by what you see in them that they've received it and they've accepted it.
Okay.
Basically, it all comes from a suspicion that there's not a lot of real interacting happening because people aren't free to listen to each other, because as a member of my church, I'm evangelizing because my pastor told me to do that, and I've become convinced that that's my job, that's my great commission. And I don't know how to reconcile that without feeling like it's just a sales
job. So it's just a role you're taking on with the method that goes along with it, rather than an earnest, serious, sober dialogue with another.
Yeah, well, and the question becomes, in talking about Van Til, when do you really get those opportunities, and what's an appropriate way to seek them?
Okay.
What I hear in my church is, let's think of more creative ways to appeal to our culture so we can have these opportunities. I don't see any other way of doing that than trying to become more appealing to our culture. That's postmodern.
Okay. Okay.
And it seems like that isn't going to work.
Jack, would you define the logical functions, law of non-contradiction, law of excluded middle, and the third one, the name of which I've forgotten, as well as give examples again of those assumptions that are the basis, or I think you call them the operations or the procedures that we use, that you're also describing as foundational beliefs? Because I want to make sure I've got a as clear a handle as possible on what I really do have in common with my postmodern friend.
Okay.
So where to really start?
Well, the law of non-contradiction is that A is not equal to not A at the same time and in the same respect. That is, that if you've got one thing and you've got another thing that's not that, then they're not the same. Well, that's elementary. I mean, every baby functions on that principle. As Aristotle points out, language would be impossible if the law of non-contradiction were not functioning. Because if I use a word and it means A, but A can be the same as not A, then the word can also not mean what it means, which destroys language. So that's foundational, that's fundamental. The law of excluded middle is that if A implies B, and B implies C, then A implies C. And so, oh, don't ask me to use a real. that chain of reasoning is something that all of reasoning is founded on. I mean, the reason we can see something that's true at the beginning of a chain of reasoning and jump to the end without going through all the steps in between, because if this leads to this, which leads to this, which leads to this, which leads to this, then this leads to this. I mean, this implies this. That's the law of excluded middle. What else did you talk as
well? Well, the third one, which is law of identity, is that right? What's the third one? Well, you don't have to necessarily.
I don't know, my logic is rusty, but... what? I talked about cause and effect. As a foundational belief, Thomas Reed says that our belief that everything has a cause is foundational, is built in, is fundamental. So I use the example of Bertrand Russell saying to Copleston, I don't have to have an explanation for where the universe came from. He can say that, but what I would argue is we all know that that goes against every fiber of our rationality. That is anti-intelligent to say that. We are doing violence to our intelligence when we say that, because it's not true. He needs an explanation just as much as anybody else does, and he knows it. But he's in a corner where Copleston is going to say, that's God, and Bertrand, that's a given for Bertrand Russell. There is no God, and one way to block coming to the conclusion that there's a God is I don't have to have an explanation. So that's the funny thing about these things, is in the worldview that I can construct, I can indeed construct a worldview that rejects everything that was foundational to me building that worldview. But what kind of worldview... Why would I embrace a worldview that destroys everything that I can't help but operate according to? That's part of Reed's argument. What sense does that make?
Using those things up there in order to...
Exactly. So why should that be an attractive worldview to me if I'm denying the very things that I have to use in order to assert it? Then why would that be attractive to me? Well, we know the answer to that, because it can rule out God. That's why it can be attractive.
Besides cause and effect, can you give some other examples of foundational beliefs?
Reed has a list of a dozen or so that he outlines. By memory, I don't think I can, but the external world, I exist, my own, the existence of myself, the existence of the external world, the cause and effect relationship, the principle of credulity, the fact that we believe we can learn from others' experience. We don't have to have personal experience. Other people can tell us about their experience, and that can be data from which I form knowledge.
Communication self-works.
I'm sorry?
Communication works.
Yeah. I don't know if he concludes that, but yeah. Our belief in the adequacy of language, I think I would put in that category. That kind of stuff.
I have a question related to that question that Earl just asked about wrong. Sort of another possible category besides ROM and RAM. I'll just throw this past you and see what you think. And the background of it is in relation to language. I read a book called Language Instinct, and the argument was basically that we have, if you want to give another word for it, maybe a separate part, sockets or something, some place in our mind that is ready and capable and built to receive language, to make language. So in some sense, there's structures already built in our mind besides principles of law of non-contradiction, besides rational structures. There's also structures like a language structure that is built, hardwired into our mind, into our existence, such that we naturally pick up language when it's thrown at us. We have a space for it. It fits. It works. Everything happens the way it's according to because we've been built that way. Could that be sort of a foundational structure?
Yeah. Broadly speaking, I'm including that in ROM, but yeah, that's the firmware of of our minds. That's a good point. In fact, Reed does, I don't remember how he gets at it, but he says something similar to that, not with that level of sophistication that I think linguists have today, but he says something similar to that. And don't get me wrong, I don't think Reed has analyzed what I'm calling the ROM. He has given us the definitive analysis of that. I think we've learned more since him. We know more. We can continue to explore that, be self-reflective, and analyze how is it that our minds have to work and can be more accurate about that. I think we can continue to learn about that. And, yeah, I heard there's a linguistic theory that part of the brain is very, very active until about the age of 12, at which point it begins to shut down. And that's why when you learn a language early, you can speak without an accent, like a native speaker would speak. But after that point, it's very difficult to learn to speak without an accent because that part of your brain has stopped absorbing language, in effect.
So, Jack, the ROM of our logical foundational beliefs is just as similar to our built-in physical instincts of eating and surviving and sleeping. And
yeah, I don't know if they're directly analogous because they may not be quite as biologically rooted as some of our instincts. I mean, they are rational. They have to do with my mind and maybe not necessarily my brain. I mean, I don't have a clue of the relationship between the mind and the brain. I think they're different, but they're obviously are related and connected, and I don't have a clue how they go together. So
would you include I think you'd include the desire to know in this, in the ROM, and to learn.
Yep.
And what about a moral conscience of already knowing what's right and wrong? Would you include that in ROM, or is that a derived belief?
Actually, Reed addresses that. I think that's probably similar to language. There's a space for it, but I don't think we have any specific moral beliefs, but we have the capability of absorbing them and learning them, I think. But don't take my word for that. I mean, I'd have to think about that more, and I don't remember what Reed says about that, but it may be more along the lines of language.
Then when do you think we are become accountable morally from young people? You know, since I forget how it's been taught to me ever since I was little, but, you know, you're a sinner from day one, you're rebellious of God, and, you know, when did that happen with respect to our, because if you, when does my son Donovan, who's two, I mean, I can already see, of course, a lot of rebellion, but so he, this ram is working so soon, that's where the sin takes place, is in the ram.
Well, I would actually put sin outside of this whole thing. I have to construct out of my freedom, and what steps into the gap of my freedom here, what the Bible calls my heart, my will, you might call it my will, I think that's where sin resides. I feel funny even talking about it in those terms, but I think the place to locate sin is not so much in rationality, but is in will. It enters into my rationality here as I, in my sinfulness, freely choose to conform to the worldview of the world. So it affects my reason, but I don't think it originates in my reason. I think it originates in the sinfulness of the human will.
So even just selfishness in a child and not wanting to share.
Right. Because sin doesn't only affect the way we look at the world and think about the world, but what we want, what we desire as well. I mean, it affects more than just reason. And I think its origin is in that willfulness where we want to displace God and we want to be the center of the universe instead of letting the center of the universe be the center of the universe. And that fundamental desire is a perverse desire that is probably with us from conception. I mean, if I were betting, that's what I would bet at this point, that that's with us from the very get-go. It's just that sin manifests itself in more and more adult and sophisticated ways the more our mind and knowledge grows.
It's my understanding that one of the reasons for distinguishing between Ram and Ram is that Ram is a critical principle. Like if one's being rational, if one's allowing the rules that govern the mind to run freely in a pure desire to know or something like that, without getting in the way of that in your personal bias and all those other things, that can be a critical principle for the things that happen at the level of RAM. And I'm wondering if you believe that to be the case.
Mm-hmm.
And also, what is the relationship between like you've already talked about, the will, and like where does the critical principle lay? Is it in RAM or is it in the will? Like, can RAM function freely and still come up with what we would know as a sinful RAM? Or does a critical principle, in that case, the critical principle would be in the will. But if it can run only, if it can only produce something like a true RAM, if it runs freely, then the critical principle relies in RAM.
Right. Does that make sense? I think the ability to self-correct is built into rationality. Whether or not we will allow ourselves the self-correction that reason and rationality requires and demands is affected by this freedom of choice that is affected by the will, it seems to me. So
is sufficient critical principle, like the laws of the rational laws?
Well, it's not sufficient in that alone will bring about the self-correction, but if in my freedom I allow it to happen, it will be sufficient, I think.
Okay, so sufficient apparatus?
A sufficient apparatus. Good, yeah. It's a sufficient apparatus, but whether or not it will be allowed to operate, that's where I, in my freedom, can block it. So what usually happens is, you know, my sin is largely unconcerned with the vast majority of my beliefs. It will allow me to come to truth like crazy. So I can be over here in the laboratory studying butterflies, and I can come to all kinds of truths about this butterfly, this species of butterfly, because it's so, it's marginal. If we take the center as being the most important truths that have the biggest impact on my life and how I should lead my life, sin, my own sinfulness only gets worried the closer I get to the center, as I'm looking at it. And in our, some people have a lot more courage than other people. Some people can go right up to the conclusion God exists and follow it to its logical conclusions without any scruples and without any fear of danger. And then just, because they know, when I get there, I'm just going to say no. I'm just not going to go where my mind wants to take me. Other people build hedges way, 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 way out here. There's no way they're going to allow themselves even to ever come close to that. And so that's an individual kind of thing, but our sin chooses to step in and pervert the process of coming to truth at varying degrees of distance from God and the gospel and Jesus and morality and stuff like that. But I think there are various points where, as sinners, that principle steps in and begins to mess with my rationality and interfere and block us from using our freedom, blocking us from taking us where rationality ought to take us and would otherwise take us. Now, don't get me wrong. That's not the only thing that interferes with knowledge. The other one is innocent, and that's just limited experience. I just don't have enough data, and I'm trying to build a picture of the universe without all the information. That can keep me from coming to truth as well.
And possibly also misinformation or bad experience from people who give us experience,
right,
which is bad, right? That can be a real deterrent in a lot of ways to coming to truth.
Okay.
I just kind of a definition question.
Okay.
Along the lines of... you defined when you brought in the element of free choice, and then you were talking about its relationship.
Sorry.
Okay, you brought in the element of free choice, and you were relating it to this block of elements right there: culture, social network, and parents.
Okay.
And then I tried to follow, and this was in the context of. Do not be conformed to the world, but let that part in 1 John.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So all I got down in my notes was the modernist. Actually, I can't read my notes because I. but my question would be: is if you're setting postmodernism and our theology opposite one another? How do you define, what role do you define free choice playing in relation to these? So you were starting to say that we presuppose that we shouldn't presuppose those things, and then free choice played a role in that. Those are the elements.
Okay, yeah, okay. Yeah, I think ultimately we don't have to be influenced by these things. We ultimately allow ourselves to be influenced by these things. So to the extent that these things are at play, that's more a generalized description of how it actually does work, not how it has to work. Because we are called at times to stand against our culture. Jesus says, I've come to put enmity between father and, well, you know, whatever, the relative. We need to reject our friends and the influence that they have on us at times. I mean, if we are going to love God, we will have to forsake these things at times. And we do have the freedom to do it, but most people, most of the time, don't. Most people, most of the time, have passions within them that lead to compliance and conformity.
And
that's partly what Nietzsche's...
The second worldview.
Pardon me?
This is when, after they deconstruct...
Yeah.
And
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, this happens at a lot of different levels, diet, fashion, all that kinds of stuff. You know, for the most part...
You would then, if you were concerned, I don't know, if you have the free choice when you're a kid to not be influenced by a parent.
Not really, no.
Yeah.
I mean, we all know kids who take that choice, but... But, you know... Yeah.
But in the second, starting a second worldview, you then can kind of make that choice
right.
Doing that. But in the first one,
okay. But not because it's mechanically necessary. You see what I'm saying? It's if one, in their freedom, chose to be a rebellious kid from the get-go and take on a whole other worldview, they could do that. Doesn't happen very often.
And so if you're supposing modernism as the backbone of the individual making choices inspired by these things, is modernism saying that rationality will eventually prevail, and then postmodernism is saying. What is postmodernism saying?
that the powerful are going to use rationality to prevail and to oppose.
And they will make free choices, and those choices will be based upon whatever of these elements grips their personal being. Whatever passions them.
Let me just start talking. I'm not sure. Yes, you're right. Absolutely right about modernism. Notice in modernism, education is going to solve all the problems of the world. Yeah, they very much believed optimistically that rationality was going to win the day and, you know, solve all of our problems and everything. Postmodernism was unconvinced, rightly so. Christianity was always unconvinced of that. But postmodernism is unconvinced of that. And so what does postmodernism do? It realizes that these are the ways in which you shape and mold someone's reason. So you enter into these institutions and use them and manipulate them to create people to think the way you want them to think. That's exactly where the political correctness movement is coming from. If we as an institution, an academic institution, can call you a homophobe, which is a four-letter word, if I can call you a homophobe if you believe that homosexuality is a sin, maybe I can actually rework the way you think about homosexuality and the perspective you take on it. So I'm going to recreate your mind, I'm going to transform your mind, and I'm going to make it conform to my ideal of how the human mind should think. And to most postmodernists, that's all there is. I mean, all there is a mind shaped by culture, and I like the mind that I would shape better than the mind that's out there now, so I'm going to grab hold of the sources of power in our culture and use them to reshape and rewire the way you think. And that's through political correctness that they're attempting to do that in, is one of the strategies, one of the tools. If I can control your language, they argue, I can control your thought. By controlling your language, I'm controlling your perspective.
And you said that sin resides somewhere else besides in the RAM. That's what I'm understanding. Now, I was just thinking of 1 Corinthians 2 where it says, no one knows the thoughts of a man except the spirit of man which is in him. So my mind's going to this tripartite. I'm trying to figure out what does a man consist of? And is a spirit different from the RAM? If the spirit of man alone knows the thoughts of a man, it seems to me to be saying, well, the spirit is different from the RAM, at least. Any thoughts on that? That's not really a question, just thoughts that are going through my head.
I'd have to think about that. I'd have to go back in that context and remember what I think about what I think that means. Let me just make this comment. I think we make a mistake to try to create an anatomy of the spirit or the soul or even a man from the scripture, because I don't think they're using those as technical terms in the same way an anatomy professor would say this part is named this and this part is named this and this part is named this. So I think those terms often overlap. So spirit and heart are largely synonymous. Mind and spirit are sometimes synonymous, sometimes not synonymous. That I think they're using them as technical terms with exact definitions. So when we assume that, of course, then we want to create an anatomy. But I'm just not convinced that's the way they're using them. Which means each context we need to revisit the question. We just need to determine what do you mean by this term in this context, this time.
Yeah, I'm interested to see what you think about the free choice aspect of RAM for the unregenerate. I'm not convinced that...
I'm not saying it's in the RAM. I'm saying these are the things that come together to determine how we construct our RAM.
Okay, so that would be an aspect of redemption, the free choice. That's a faculty of the soul or the spirit that's at work in this culturally created, you know, RAM part of my existence.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Yep. Just before we run out of time, let me just mention just throughout one of the important implications of all this, and that is the New Testament is concerned with the culture of the world as opposed to the culture of belief, if you will. But there's another level at which this becomes important. If what I'm saying here is true, we need to realize how much the culture of Christianity that we are a part of shapes our minds. Oftentimes, it shapes it toward the truth, but not necessarily. And that's the thing that we can be sensitive to here that many Christians often are not sensitive enough to, because they equate the cultural mindset that they have inherited with the truth of Christianity itself, and are unable or unwilling and don't feel any invitation or freedom to be self-critical about their own tradition, their own culture, their own denomination, their own, you know, whatever you want to call it. Whereas it seems to me that we need to constantly be in a process of self-correction in our understanding of the faith. I don't have everything right. And so as I read more of the Bible, read more scripture, learn more from the scripture, experience more things, see more things, to be constantly reevaluating my underlying assumptions about what the faith is all about, the hierarchy of values that I place on things and so on. Did I have that right or didn't I? We're going to automatically, rationally, rightly so, assume that I got it right and try to interpret everything in the light of that. That's only rational to do that. But when I come to a point where it doesn't work any longer, then I cease being rational if, when my paradigm has stopped working, I insist on the paradigm anyway instead of go looking for a new paradigm. At that point, the rational thing is to shift paradigms. I don't mean go from belief to unbelief. I mean, although that would be true too, if Christianity weren't true. We shouldn't believe it if it's not true. But I mean in the particulars of my theology, in the particular way that I articulate the faith to myself, if I don't have it right, don't I want to change? Don't I want to get it right? Don't I want to tell myself a different story, paint a different picture of the faith in order to make it truer to God, reality, Jesus, the gospel, and so on? So that should be an ongoing process in our lives. There's no merit in getting stuck. And yet we have baptized in the name of faith stuckness, being in a theological rut, we've baptized that as some kind of loyalty to the tradition or even calling it faith itself. But I just think this is an ongoing process.
I mean, I already talked to you a little bit about parts of postmodernism in the arts that I find fun and good. And I guess my hope would be in the Christendom that as soon as something starts to look like postmodernism, that I don't get scolded for needing to throw everything out, because there's just a vote that, particularly in the arts, there's something about how my bent to pull bits from different time periods and different styles, for instance, in the pastiche idea, to find a deeper meaning and coherence. Even if I can't articulate it yet, it may be instinctive in what I'm drawn to, that I think in some of those ways the church can, or not just the church, but we as believers can continue in borrow forms of postmodern expression to communicate more and more clearly, not just so we can communicate to others, but also it's the way I'm finding myself wanting to express, and that I would just hope for some understanding in
right.
Christendom that there can be a measure of borrowing these styles that is how we communicate, and it's not necessarily lacking in an underlying truth.
Yeah, that's good, and I don't want anything that I'm saying to be construed as ruling that out, because I think if we have a biblical worldview, if we have a true worldview, one of the things that worldview is going to allow me to do is to be able to distinguish between things that are objectively true, created by God, natural and fixed, and things that are fluid and dynamic because they are and morally neutral. And it seems to me that the genre of theater, the genre of music, the genre of art is a human artifact that is fluid, dynamic, flexible. And we are in a very fun time in that regard, to be able to mix elements together. And there's two things, I think, that have contributed to that. One is technology. I mean, it's just the instant access to cultures the other side of the world that are doing a whole nother gig than we are, and to be able to learn from that, incorporate the elements of that into our stuff. I mean, we just know so much more. It's such a shrunk-down world. So that certainly contributed to that. And then the second thing is, it may very well be that postmodern philosophy has jarred us out of our ruts to make it psychologically possible for us to do that with a freedom that we didn't have before. And I'd say that's okay. As long as we are critical from the standpoint of a biblical worldview to make the distinction between what I'm doing as an artist and what is true of objective reality. Because I have the freedom to... Okay, let me take another example. For the postmodernist, mixing musical styles and creating a whole new music is no different in kind or nature than inventing a whole new approach to sexuality. Reinventing myself sexually is exactly the same as reinventing myself musically. From a biblical worldview, we look at that going, no, it's not. Those aren't the same. But I have a worldview that allows me to make that distinction. So what I'm arguing is ultimately destructive is not the kind of freedom that it gives an artist like you to experiment and stuff like that. What's destructive is when we start experimenting morally and experimenting spiritually and that kind of thing. That's where postmodernism is deadly and destructive and dangerous. But we actually have a basis, a worldview, that allows us to make that kind of distinction.